It's 5:07 and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. The verdict in Bradley Manning's trial was announced today, and he's been acquitted of aiding the enemy, the most severe charge brought against him.
He was, though, convicted of lesser charges, including 5 counts of espionage.
Bradley Manning leaked the largest amount of classified information in U.S. history when he handed over CDs containing thousands of classified U.S. military and diplomatic documents to WikiLeaks.
Joining us now is Greg Mitchell, blogger for The Nation, author of Truth and Consequences, the U.S. versus Bradley Manning. Greg, thanks for joining us.
Sure, thank you.
So was this the verdict you expected following the trial?
I'm not sure. I certainly expected the convictions on almost all of the what they're called lesser charges, but as you noted, they're quite serious, most of them. I think most people, including Manning's supporters, thought he would go down on the aiding the enemy. So I think that was a little bit of surprise, but it was probably a 50-50 shot.
Even without that aiding the enemy charge, the sentence could be more than a human lifespan, right?
That's right. Well, yeah, that's right, 130 years or something. The sentencing phase starts tomorrow, and actually it could go on for 2 weeks because the defense is, from the beginning, has planned to contest and present evidence that they were not really allowed to do much at the trial relating to his motivation and to the alleged lack of harm caused by the leak. So they're really going to be marshaling forces for the sentencing, which is like a mini trial, and it's going to go on for perhaps a couple weeks.
Why wasn't he found guilty of aiding the enemy, do you think?
Well, you know, the judge has not actually explained, but you know, as you may know, there was controversy about that charge from the beginning. Partly because the media, which did not cover the trial really very much, except for big days like today. You know, the media was concerned that that sent a chilling message if he was convicted on that, because it basically, unlike previous you know, cases, was basically going to be saying that journalists and whistleblowers would be possibly get the same charge for releasing information that not really intended to be used or help the enemy or help anyone abroad, but actually could be made use of, perhaps, or allegedly made use of. And so this would supposedly have a chilling effect on journalists and whistleblowers who could get this very serious charge for really unforeseen reasons.
The phrase in the media a lot has been something along the lines of Bradley Manning, hero or traitor. And there are definitely people who have seen it both ways. He's a hero, he's a whistleblower, he revealed unjust actions by the government, or he's a traitor, he violated his oaths to the U.S. government, gave information that could have been used against us. How do you think, looking back, history is going to see him?
Well, I don't think it'll be clear either way. I think in some ways it's a cop-out for the people who have sort of gone to the, you know, both ends of that. I think history will say, much like with Edward Snowden, perhaps, that they will say that, you know, this person, for whatever motivation, to whatever extent that it went too far or not, released incredibly important information that the public was denied, that the public should have known about, and that caused a lot of positive debate, positive results in this country and other countries. So I think history will probably be much kinder to those two individuals than many pundits and others are today.
Greg, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Sure, thank you.
That's Greg Mitchell, blogger for The Nation, author of Truth and Consequences, the U.S. versus Bradley Manning.
Coming up, we'll be talking about the aviation family reunion coming up. But first, some surprising new research about what makes introverts happy.
It's not just a good book and some online chatting. According to some new findings, introverts might be happier by acting more like extroverts.
And here to talk about that research and what it might mean for introverts out there is William Fleeson, professor in the psychology department at Wake Forest University. Will, welcome to Central Time.
Hi. Well, thanks a lot for having me. I really think this the power of people to create the lives that they want to and to be who they want to be is an important topic, so I really appreciate you covering that. And if I can just take a second to say, I graduated from Madison, so I have a real fondness for that place. I really appreciate being there.
As did I, yeah. Glad to meet another Badger alum.
Glad to have you back, yeah.
Well, I want to start out by defining the terms introvert and extrovert. I'm going to just come out right now. Rob and I are both varieties of introverts, so this is interesting to us. But how do you define it? Because everyone defines it a little bit differently.
Yeah, They sure do, and I think that's a really important topic. So the definition that I'm using is the one that scientists use, and this is what I would call an empirical definition based on the way people turn out to be. And this definition of extroversion versus introversion has to do with you can basically understand it by a bunch of adjectives. So people that are extroverted tend to be more talkative, bolder, more active, more spontaneous, more assertive, more adventurous, and more sociable. People who are introverted, on the other hand, tend to be less talkative, less bold, less active, less spontaneous, less assertive, less adventurous, and less sociable.
And it's a continuum, right? It's not just A or B. It's A, B, and a lot of points in between.
Yeah, that's a really important topic. It's really important not to categorize these dimensions or reify them. So most people are pretty much in between extroversion and introversion. And there's gradual changes. You can find people at all points along introversion and extroversion.
Well, you're one of the researchers that looked at the happiness factor when introverts acted like an extrovert. Can you tell us about what you found?
Yeah, sure. I'd like to point out that the background of this research is really research that others have done. And this is research from the 80s and 90s where other people, so I can't take any credit for this research, showed that people that are more extroverted are happier than people who are more introverted. So that this dimension, people who score higher on that dimension of extroversion also score higher on the dimension of happiness. And that's research that was shown in a lot of research labs, a lot of parts of the country, a lot of age groups, a lot of different countries. And that was research going on, you know, before I was doing research on this topic. So I was still drinking schooners at the 602 Club when this was happening. And so when I heard that, I found that research fascinating. I think it's really fascinating because, A, at least three reasons here. One is it says that, you know, your personality, not your circumstances or what happens to you, has something to do with how good your life's going to be. That's exciting. Secondly, that's fascinating because it's a little threatening. It's a little bit threatening to say that, you know, you have some control over that. You have to look in the mirror, and that's a little scary. And then the third thing is the question that really interested me was, well, can we do something about that? If we can't change our personalities, does that mean we're stuck with a certain happiness level based on the findings that others were doing? I was wondering, can we do something about that to change our happiness if we want to? So that's when I started doing research on this topic.
And so you looked at introverts and tried to see, can they be a little more extroverted, and does that make them happier?
Right. The first study, I actually just asked people to tell me what they're doing. They took Palm Pilots with them for 2 weeks, five times a day. They just answered questions in the Palm Pilot to say how extroverted they were being right at that moment and then how happy they were feeling at that moment. And people varied on both of those quite a bit. Now, if you think about it, that's a lot of data for each person. So each person is like their own study in this because they have as much data as, you know, a normal psychology study has for all people. So really, we took each person as an individual and studied them individually and then calculate for each person separately how happy they felt when they were acting extroverted versus how happy they felt when they were acting introverted, and get for each person a relationship between their level of being extroverted at the moment and their level of happiness at that moment. Now, people could be in anywhere in those three groups. I mean, there could be three groups that people could fall into. They could fall in a group where, you know, it doesn't make any difference how extroverted you're acting, right? Mm-hmm. And this seems like a really good possibility for a lot of people because it, you know, your trait is what matters, right? How you are in general is what should matter, not how you are in the moment. That's sort of faking it or just putting on an act. Or it may be that introverts and extroverts just get their kicks in different ways. I know, for example, me, I would rather read a book than go to a party. And so it might just be that they get their, you know, kicks out of acting introverted, right? So maybe that there's no relationship, or it could be there's a negative relationship. So that the more extroverted you act, the less happy you are. And then there could be this group of people that are happier the moments they acted extroverted. So for dramatic pause, I'll just give people a second to sort of predict how many people fell into each of those three groups. And I'll tell you that the answer was, and we were quite shocked to find this, is that every single person in the study fell in the positive group. So every single person in the study was happier the times they were acting extroverted than the times they were acting introverted. There wasn't an exception in our study.
That seems counterintuitive. I don't know, as an introvert, especially when you talk about acting like an extrovert, doesn't that mean that there's something forced about it?
That's what it would I agree. We were quite shocked to find that. It would feel like maybe it's forced or something. So my larger research is really about the question of, can people be flexible with their personalities? And I've discovered that people all the time are being very flexible with their personalities. Extroverts and introverts alike are acting extroverted and introverted all the time already. It's not forced. It's just the natural way people are. In fact, everybody acts on all, or almost everybody, there's probably some exceptions, acts in almost all ways on every normal personality trait routinely and regularly, as a matter of course, in just a couple of weeks. In fact, people are so different from themselves over time that they're as different in their personality from moment to moment as they are in their mood. So I jokingly say, we could just as well ask people, who are you, as asking them, how are you, when we see them, because their personality is changing as much as their mood.
Interesting.
People really are. Go ahead.
We'll hear more about that, how we change our personalities coming up after the break. And we're talking about introverts, extroverts, and maybe introverts could be happier by acting, behaving more extrovertedly, if that's a word.
I was just going to ask you that.
Will Fleeson is with us, professor of psychology at Wake Forest University.
And we'd love to hear from you. If you're an introvert, how do you feel about acting like an extrovert? Do you feel like maybe you've somehow noticed the correlation that Will is talking about? You act a little more like an extrovert and you feel a little happier. Or does it seem like a stretch to you? You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. And you can send your email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks, Kristen. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. And we're taking a look at some new research right now that indicates introverts could up their happiness quotient by acting like extroverts. And we're getting your take on this too as well right now at 1-800-642-1234. If you're an introvert or an extrovert, how do you feel about this research? 1-800-642-1234 as we talk with Will Fleeson. He's a professor in the psychology department at Wake Forest University.
We'll go to the phones now. We have Nancy on the line. She's calling from Duluth. Hi, Nancy.
Hi there.
What do you think of this?
Well, I always defined introvert and extrovert a little bit differently, that an introvert gets their energy from being alone and an extrovert gets their energy from being with people. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
And I find that according to mood and energy level, you know, you can act extroverted, but if it's an act or too much of a forced thing, then it's exhausting.
Gotcha. Thanks a lot, Nancy. What do you think, Will, of that definition and that consequence of an introvert dipping their toes in the extrovert world?
So I think that that's a commonly used definition. It probably dates back to Jung. And it's a reasonable definition. It's not the definition of extroversion that we're using scientifically when we talk about extroversion. And there isn't evidence that this kind of extroversion that is associated with happiness is connected to drawing your energy from other people or not from other people. So that's a fine definition, but it wouldn't fit with this research. Could you tell me again? I didn't hear as well the second.
Well, the idea of whether it's Nancy's definition or your definition, isn't it exhausting? Doesn't it drain us to act a way that at least feels contrary to our nature?
Right. So, again, I've done a lot of research on showing how people act out of character doesn't seem to be problematic for people. In fact, I found that people, there's no relationship to how true to themselves. So I did another research where I asked people, how true to yourself do you feel when you're acting in various ways? And I found there was no relationship to how closely they were acting to their trait level and how true to themselves they felt. There just wasn't a relationship there. In my opinion, it's probably not the case that people base who they truly are on these traits. These traits are something else. They base it more on sort of their beliefs and their values and their goals. So I don't think that it necessarily feels forced, and I don't find evidence for that. I've tried to, you know, find this evidence, this idea that introverts would get tired by acting extroverted, and I haven't been able to find it yet. And a colleague of mine, John Zielinski, has found that, in fact, introverts don't seem to get tired by acting extroverted. Quite the contrary. It's the extroverts who have trouble acting introverted, if anybody does, that they get tired by doing that.
I thought I heard that part of the reason extroverts are extroverts is because they get a dopamine hit when they act like an extrovert. And if introverts don't have that, and stop me if I'm completely messing up all-knowing science, but, I mean, what would be the point of acting like an extrovert?
So there's definitely some, you know, beginning and evidence that dopamine is associated with extroversion, and that's very interesting to look at. What I'm finding is that extroverts and introverts equally get a boost out of acting extroverted. There seems to be no difference between them in the terms of their happiness. And that, in fact, extroverts won't be happier than introverts unless they act extroverted, right? So if they don't act extroverted for a week, they won't be that happy that week. So it looks to me like if there's a dopamine relationship here, that it's something that comes when you act extroverted, regardless of whether you're an extrovert or an introvert.
We'll go back to the phones now. We've got Rick with us in Mequon. Hi, Rick.
Yes, I am extreme extrovert. All the tests I've taken, Myers-Briggs, everything else. And my ex-wife, who we were married 14 years, was an extreme or is an extreme introvert. And I can tell you that it does take a lot of energy for me to act introverted, and I'm not happy when I do. And she definitely was seemed happier when we would have parties or whatever. But one thing I noticed about her and my daughter, who are introverts, I mean my son are extroverts, is after a party or after a gathering, we have even more energy, and we need to get energy when we wake up in the morning by talking with people, where the introverts seem to, like, totally be drained after a public thing, and they seem to have more energy in the morning and less at night.
Should I go ahead and...
Yeah, what do you think, Will?
Yeah, that's a great stories and a great question. And, yeah, I think extroverts really have trouble keeping their mouth shut. I'm not offending anyone. So there's this really good idea out there that he's described, which is that extroverts get energy from being out there at parties and things like that, and introverts get drained from that. And that's similar to what the first caller was saying, too. And there just isn't evidence for that yet. That doesn't mean it's not true. I just can't say that there's evidence in support of that idea. I remember, man, I've been involved with I've had many extroverted people in my life, and yes, they seem to keep going.
You know, it sounds like you tend toward the introverted. You enjoy a good book as much as the next introvert. So as such, you're probably aware that in this country, it seems as though we tilt toward the extrovert. That's what we put stock in. We put value in. And I'm thinking that's probably not true in all cultures. Do you think if you did this research in another culture that maybe leaned more toward the introverted side, you'd get different results?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. So, first of all, it has been found in every culture that it's been tested in that the people who are more extroverted are happier than people who are more introverted. So even in cultures like Japan, so it looks like value doesn't affect that relationship. Now, this within-person relationship, when a person changes their level of extroversion or introversion, do they feel happy or not, might change across cultures. We haven't tested that across cultures. Actually, when it came out, one of the people who wrote, who commented in this Wall Street Journal article recently, I just was exchanging with email with him, we might be starting a study to look at this across cultures to see what would happen in other cultures. So it's a really good question.
Well, I've got to ask, you're doing this research. Are you experimenting with this in your daily life, trying to pick out some more extroverted behaviors and putting them to the test?
Yeah. So, the question is whether I'm an introvert or an extrovert and embarrassedly, I've kind of lost track of that.
You don't know who you are anymore.
Right. Because my research is really focused about who I'm being at the time. And, I do pay attention, and there are times when what I want is to have fun, and in those times I will act more extroverted in order to have more fun. However, I don't think that having fun or being happy in this particular sense is the only goal in my life, and so I only do it when that's the goal that I have.
So introverts should practice this with care.
I think there are a lot of reasons you won't want to act extroverted in many situations.
Well, it's interesting research, and I guess Rob and I will be doing some experimenting this weekend.
Definitely.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us, and keep us posted on what you find if you do more research.
And thank you so much again for having me and covering this topic.
We've been talking to Will Fleason, professor in the psychology department at Wake Forest University.
I'm going to try to find ways to put this to the test. I don't know how exactly yet, but I'm going to pick a couple opportunities to act more like an extrovert in public and see if I feel happier.
All right. Yeah. We'll check in on the Rob extrovert status later on. And coming up, we check out the problem of plastic in the Great Lakes and get a taste of the Experimental Aircraft Association's big gathering in Oshkosh. That's coming up. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Stay with us. You're listening to Central Time. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll talk about plastic pollution in the Great Lakes.
But first, an annual meeting of amateur aviators, the world's greatest aviation celebration.
We're talking about the EAA Air Venture. That's the Experimental Aircraft Association.
The week-long celebration happens each year in Oshkosh, Wisconsin.
Here to tell us what to expect is EAA spokesperson Dick Napinski. Dick, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thank you so much. Happy to be with you this afternoon.
What is AirVenture?
Well, AirVenture, you mentioned it, is the world's greatest aviation celebration. It is officially the annual convention of our Experimental Aircraft Association, but it really becomes, I guess I would call it, aviation's family reunion, because no matter what people like to fly, what they like to see fly, and what they enjoy out on the flight line, it's here, and people come from more than 65 countries to be a part of it each year, and it really does make the world's largest general aviation gathering.
Experimental aircraft sounds like a lot of fun, maybe some UFO-type stuff. What are some of the more experimental things we see at this annual event?
Well, some of them truly are experimental. The Experimental Aircraft Association really came out of the category from the FAA. It's not a factory-built aircraft. It's one built by those who put it together themselves, whether from a set of plans or a kit. For instance, this year we're seeing a flying car from Terra Fugia out in Massachusetts. It flew on Monday, first time it'd flown at a public U.S. air show. Today we're seeing the first jet-powered human, a man named Yves Rossi from Switzerland. He's called Jetman, and he has a carbon fiber wing that has four small jet engines underneath it, and he'll drop from a helicopter, ignite those engines, and fly for about 10 minutes before parachuting to a landing. So those are just some of the things. Most of them are pretty much more conventional, your Cessnas and Beechcraft and Piper aircraft, and some things, brand new corporate jets, different things coming across too, but the whole gamut is here in Oshkosh this week.
And so some people just do airplanes as a hobby, it sounds like.
They do. There are more than 30,000 home-built aircraft in the United States, fully inspected, fully registered, flown thousands of hours each year. And so you can build them from a kit or a set of plans and create something that you would not be able to buy off the factory floor, and something that's a lot less expensive, too.
I would be hesitant, well, first, to fly on that flying wing jumping out of a helicopter, or to fly in something that I personally put together. These people have some guts, it sounds like.
Well, it's not so much guts. It's really something that people enjoy doing. Most people who build aircraft are very experienced pilots. They've been flying for years, but yet they see a type of airplane that they can't find through the factory builds, or they see a design or something that they want to put together themselves. And, of course, the biggest thing is probably price. The basic four-seat airplane these days runs for about $200,000 or more, but if you take a look at some of the home-built aircraft, you can find a two-place aircraft that goes faster, is more fuel-efficient, and costs about $150,000 less once you get it completed.
How do people get into this? Is this something that is a family tradition for some folks, or is it just a unique type of hobbyist?
It's a little bit of both. Some people are part of an aviation family, three, four generations of aviators who have always been around the airport. Others are interested in flying for whatever captures their imagination about the world of flight. Most of us start in the basic small Cessna or Piper aircraft, learning how to fly. And then as our hours grow, our experience grows, and our knowledge grows about the entire world of aviation, then we start to explore other avenues. Is something such as home building for me? Is it something that you want to get into jet aircraft? Is it something that a person wants to start flying ultralights? All of those things become kind of a stepladder to more experience and more fun within the world of flight.
Does it happen that something we see at this event, something experimental today, in maybe a decade, we see it out on the runways of airports around the country?
Very much so. It's happened all the time. When you take a look at some of the current landing gear on small aircraft, when you look at the winglets, for instance, that are on commercial jetliners now, the little things that stick up in the air at the end of the wings, the winglets, that helps fuel efficiency on the big jets, that actually had its start in experimental aviation and home-built aviation. Designers looked at that, created a more efficient airflow over the wings, and created a better efficiency with their fuel as well. And eventually it worked its way into small jets and eventually big passenger jets too.
I can't help but think of the Wright brothers when you're talking about the people who do this. Just a couple of guys, bicycle shop owners, tinkering and trying to make something fly where other people couldn't. Do you feel like there's that tradition, that history running through the event?
There really is. If you look back at the Wright brothers, they indeed were the first amateur home builders of aircraft, and they had the first successful one. And since then, it's built up through the years, mostly through the first couple of decades of flight. Everybody was a home builder, an experimenter. But then new designs come forward, and light aircraft, fast aircraft, and so forth really got its start. Somebody taking an idea and exploring it, not so much in a corporate atmosphere, but exploring it with their own hand in mind, moving forward and trying to make something better all the way around.
So at the event this week, run us through a couple of the interesting things we might see if we check it out.
Well, we talked about Jetman this year. He'll be flying on Tuesday, Thursday, Saturday, and Sunday. The flying car is scheduled to fly on Wednesday once again this year. People will see the world's only civilian-owned Harrier jump jet. It will be here flying during the air show. People will see some of the world's greatest aerobatic performers, and they will see some innovation, people who are working on new designs, things that may use inducted fans, may use unique wing designs, folding wing designs. Where is the world of aviation going next? They can talk to astronauts who will discuss the space program as it's been and what it's in the future. And they can have some fun, too. Things such as Disney's brand new airplane movie, Planes, which comes out August 9th, will be screened early, a week early, here at Oshkosh on August 2nd. So people who are captured by airplanes can have their imaginations captured by Disney and their look at airplanes as well.
I got to ask about the history. How did this event come to be in Oshkosh?
Well, it's always been a Wisconsin organization. EAA was founded, and you can probably hear airplanes in the background.
I was going to ask,
yeah. As we speak. But it started in 1953 in Milwaukee. And the first fly-ins through the 1950s were in Milwaukee, and they eventually outgrew what's now Timmerman Airport. And then they moved down to Rockford throughout the 1960s. In 1969, it had outgrown its facility at Rockford, so at that point, they were looking for a new area. And the unique thing about Whitman Field here at Oshkosh is there are two long runways that don't cross. And since they don't cross, you can bring in a lot of airplanes and a lot of traffic, park cars and aircraft throughout the grounds. So it came to Oshkosh in 1970 and has been here ever since. And now Oshkosh is known around the world as a word in aviation. People come from more than 65 nations to be here.
I got to ask, I don't know if you're by a window, but what's buzzing around out there? What kind of plane are you seeing?
Right now, looking out over and trying to get a quick look, that appears to be a small aerobatic aircraft. I think it might be an extra or something like that, something that people can do a very rapid roll rate in, something as fast as 2 seconds, completely do a 360-degree roll. And so that's part of the air show here every afternoon, some of the world's best aerobatic pilots that fly here at Oshkosh.
I'm getting queasy just hearing about it. So I've been seeing planes, unusual planes, flying in and out of Madison here. Do we see planes staging in from around the state?
You really do. They use airports, not only staging, but some people park here in east central Wisconsin to be a part of it. They'll park hundreds of airplanes in Fond du Lac, in Appleton, places like Wautoma, New Holstein, Brennan Field outside Neenah, up in Green Bay, even down in Madison, will be a part of the entire event, and they'll commute up. And so more than 10,000 airplanes come to the area total to be a part of this event each year.
Dick, thanks a lot for joining us today.
It's my pleasure. Thanks so much.
That's Dick Nepinski. He's a spokesperson for the Experimental Aircraft Association.
Coming up, we'll hear about plastic pollution in the Great Lakes. Now, we've heard about plastic pollution going on in the oceans of the world, and now it turns out there's evidence that the same thing is happening in Great Lakes water. We'll get the scoop on that. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Turning our attention to the Great Lakes now, the lakes contain about one-fifth of the world's fresh water supply.
And preservation of all that fresh water has been a challenge. There's been industrial pollution, there has been algae and invasive mussels, and that's just naming a few of the challenges.
Well, now a group of chemists from universities in the Great Lakes region recently began testing the water for plastic as well. A report out today confirms that small particles of plastic are yet another challenge in preserving the lakes.
Here to talk about this is one of the chemists who've been involved in the study, Dr. Lorena Rios. She's an assistant professor of chemistry at UW-Superior. And Lorena, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Now, we've heard a lot of attention being focused in the past about plastics polluting the ocean. There's been the garbage island in the Pacific, which I guess is largely made up of plastic. What's the evidence that there's plastic pollution happening in the Great Lakes, too?
Yes, in the last year, we went to collect plastic samples to the Lake Superior, Huron, and Erie, and we find a lot of microplastic pellets in the Lake Erie, and this is a big problem because it's not the total amount of plastic that we find by weight, it's the amount in quantity. We find between 500 to 600. 100,000 pieces per square kilometer. And the main problem with these very small plastic sizes is that it's easily accessible to the freshwater organism. This means it's easily confused with natural food.
So in other words, fish could be eating it.
Yes, they can eat it. And the other big problem is that the plastic can absorb persistent organic pollutants that some of them are endocrine disruptors. And then we don't know what's going on with the when the fish eat this plastic with these pollutants and what happened when we eat this fish. This is the main problem.
So what kind of plastic are we talking about? Not all plastic is the same, right?
No, we have different kind of plastic, but the plastic that we found is we collected just in the surface water, and then this means need to be some plastic that is very similar in density to the water, and the mainly is polyethylene and polypropylene, and it is the most common plastic used in our society.
Now, are these plastics that have any health risks that go along with them? Are they carcinogens, for instance?
Yes, that I analyzed in the plastic from the Lake Erie, I found the concentration in polyaromatic in double concentration that I found in the Atlantic Ocean.
Double the concentration is the plastic
double
in the Atlantic?
Double the concentration, yes. And the main problem, you know, we need to think always in the dilution factor. The ocean is so big and the Lake Erie is small and shallow, but still the concentration for the polyaromatic hydrocarbons is the double in concentration by gram.
Lorena, why are we first discovering this now? I've been hearing about plastic in oceans for years now. Why are we first hearing about it in the Great Lakes?
You know, the last year was the first time that we went to collect samples. I was working in the North Pacific Yard, and then when I moved here to Wisconsin, I said, you know, the plastic is everywhere, and then I need to know what's going on in the lakes, and we found it.
Now, this is also potential drinking water. The Great Lakes are often referred to, you know, it's one-fifth of the world's drinking water, something like that. Do I have that right? Yeah, one-fifth of the world's fresh water supply. So we need to care about what's in Great Lakes water. What do we do at this point?
I think we start just now with this research. And I know, for example, the problem that we found in the Lake Erie is the very small pellets, perfectly round pellets that we think it maybe is from some beauty products.
From beauty products, I don't know. What would you find that in, like an exfoliating sort of product?
Yes, something like that, you know, because the sizes is, you need to use the microscope and then you can see it. This means it's very small, the size. And microplastic is defined by NOAA, whatever is plastic that is equal or smaller than 5 millimeters. And then we found some of them, and we find different fragments, different colors and sizes and shapes. But still, we're thinking that maybe it's from this very wrong pellet. The perfect pellets are from the beauty product. And you can see in the beauty products, you can read the labels, and you can read polypropylene or polyethylene.
Hmm.
That is plastic. Yeah.
So how are cosmetics companies responding if we've gotten in touch and said, you know what, these plastic pellets are showing up in the Great Lakes? I suppose the first thing to do is to ask them to stop.
Yeah. Dr. Marcus Erickson from the Fajars Institute started talking with the industry about this kind of compounds. Some of them, they say that they will start to searching again to go back with the natural products, but this may be taken like 5, 8, 7 years.
Years,
yeah.
I don't know. How do those numbers sound to you as a scientist who studies the Great Lakes? That sounds like a long time to me.
I know, but you know, the main point here is that we need to continue on doing the research, and then we need to find the facts and the real data and something like that that we can show to the people in power to do something, yes. And then for that, we need to do new researches about the implication, about this unclear consequence for the food chain by plastic ingestion by fish, for example.
Right, because a lot of anglers, I mean, that's a big tourism industry, too. It's not just a water supply. Anglers bring tourism and money to these regions around the Great Lakes. So I suppose that's key, is figuring out whether the fish are being affected.
Yes, I think now we need to add a new contaminant in the water, that is the plastic. And the main point here is to tell the people that we are the source. And then we need to stop to using plastic or reuse the plastic or refuse, recycle, do something with the plastic. Because if you don't see the plastic, it doesn't mean that this disappears, you know. Mm-hmm. We can find it in the Great Lakes or in the ocean.
Now, I understand you've specifically done testing on fish. You cut them open as part of your research. Do you see evidence of that plastic in the fish so far?
We opened already 120 samples from the Lake Superior, and just we find in 20 stomach, we find the very small fibers of plastic, not in a huge amount, but we found it. And we start to analyze now with the fish, the intestine, and the stomach from the Lake Erie. And we opened already 20, and we don't see any. But I'm sure we find it from the Lake Erie. We can find plastic. Because, you know, the concentration of the amount of plastic, microplastic in the Lake Erie is huge.
So essentially you're saying if you're seeing it in the fish, odds are, you know, we're eating it if we're eating those fish.
Yeah. But we need to study more to see what is the transfer of these pollutants to the organisms and what's going on with the organisms. See, the problem is stop in the fish, or the problem go with us when we eat at the fish.
Now, you mentioned Lake Erie, and that's where you've done a lot of your work. Is it possible that the pollution looks worse than it is because you're using Lake Erie's water? Don't the other lakes empty into Lake Erie?
You know, I've seen the main situation is all the people around to the Lake Erie. The second is that we can see is the very small lake and shallow, and we can see how the water from the other lakes, Superior, Michigan, and Huron, go to the Lake Erie.
Mm-hmm.
And then maybe this is one source. We don't know yet. And in this August, I will go to collect samples in the Lake Michigan, Huron, and the river St. Clair River, and I hope so I can go to the Erie again, and then we can see. We need to continue with this research, taking samples to see complete the picture about the plastic pollution in the Great Lakes.
So if there is this pollution building up in the lakes, how long would it take to clear up pollution like that?
Oh, I really don't know, because in the sizes that we have, I'm talking the microplastic, that is the worst plastic. I really don't know. I don't know if we really can clean.
We're still in the beginning phases, sounds like.
Yes.
So given what we know about how long there's been awareness about plastic pollution in the oceans, now we're finding it in the Great Lakes, how do you feel about the chances for addressing this possible pollution, or that we found the pollution? How do you feel about the chances of addressing it quickly and addressing it carefully and well?
I think we are doing a really good job, you know, because this the plastic problem is coming from 1970s when the first researchers, they started saying, you know, hey, look at this, there is plastic, the pre-production pellets, we can find it in the ocean. But it's like, oh, it's okay, the plastic don't do anything, it's no big deal. But then in 1992, it's again when the West reporter in the North Pacific Jar that the concentration in the plastic is 6 to 1. This means 6 kilos of plastic against 1 kilo.
And Dr. Lorena, I'm so sorry, but we have to leave it there. But thank you so much for talking about this with us today. Appreciate it.
Okay, thank you.
That was Dr. Lorena Rios, Assistant Professor of Chemistry at UW-Superior. This is Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio.